Please, my name is Martin Freeman. I represent the appellants. My registration number is 19263. With me is co-counsel Kathy Gowdy, whose registration number is 28436. There are four basic issues before the court on this appeal. One has to do with the striking of one expert witness. The second also has to do with the striking of a different expert witness. The third and the fourth have to do with what we believe is a misapplication of the rule and what must be disclosed with regard to treating doctors. And the fourth one has to do with requiring of the plaintiffs to do something which was impossible for them to do. Mr. Baker was the first expert that the court struck. This case was set for trial on January 18th, 2010, and a motion for summary judgment was fully briefed and argued, and the court denied that motion a month before trial on December 17th of 2009. On the 31st of 2009, New Year's Eve, the court struck Mr. Baker as an expert witness, principally on the ground that he was not timely endorsed. They denied the motion for reconsideration on January 8th, 2010. With regard to the other expert witness, the court on January 4th, 2 weeks before trial, scheduled a Schreck hearing to be held 6 business days before trial. Permitted the defense to endorse an expert to testify on January 5th, 3 days before the Schreck hearing, with no opportunity on the part of my clients to investigate with regard to what he might say. And the court said they were troubled by that lack of notice, and hoped they wouldn't have to use what he said, but the court, in apparently deciding the issue of causation, which should have been left to the jury, went ahead and relied on what Dr. Waxman had to say anyway. With regard to the first issue, Mr. Baker, the principal tangent that we believe the trial court went off on with regard to him is that despite having reserved our right to call expert witnesses designated by the other side on September 24th of 2009 in a timely fashion, said that they had not been designated as an expert. And so it really came down to this. When Mr. Baker was endorsed 18 months before they moved to preclude him, it was clear that he was an expert. That became absolutely clear 14 months before they moved to strike him, when his reports and his findings from the sampling and his conclusions about the dangerous level of mold that was there were all disclosed by the defense to us. This was an expert witness that had been retained by another party who's not in the case anymore, but pursuant to a written agreement between that other party and the defense, the landowners, they would work together. And so they had full access to him, to interview him, to do anything they wanted to do with regard to him. Nevertheless, the court said, because when those reports were disclosed, the magic words, "this is an expert," were not used, so therefore our reserving the right to call experts designated by the other side went by the boards in what has to be in my opinion, one of the most hyper-technical rulings as well that I've ever seen. All of the case law says that if he was endorsed as an expert, clearly our reservation of rights, and this is in all the cases are in our brief, our reservation of rights would permit us to call him. But the court said, well, he didn't say he was an expert. All one must do is read what was disclosed by the landowners with regard to Mr. Baker, and one knows that he tested the samples indoors and out, found the mold, found it in the structure, found it in the air, said it's dangerous, it's at high levels, here's what you have to do to remedy it. This is an expert witness. And yet the court found they didn't say the word expert when he was disclosed in the initial disclosures, and therefore did not allow him to testify. Even though when the court denied the motion for summary judgment, she said, based upon the opinions of Mr. Baker and Mr. Shoemaker. So even she recognized that he was an expert. There are a couple other points with regard to Mr. Baker, and I'm very aware that the time is passing, but the defense raises a different issue. They raised the issue that they were surprised because they didn't know that we had the intent to call him. The case law, however, is very clear that is not the kind of surprise they're talking about. The both the brand names, prescription drugs case, Kendall Oil, and Kendall Oil making it clear that the intent of the opponent is not a basis for claiming surprise and prejudice. The trial judge ruled otherwise. At 879 F. Second 242-243, the court wrote, although Kendall claimed to be surprised by Homco's decision, it had no basis other than its own unawareness for shock. After all, Kendall had interviewed Morgan and put him on the list. In our case, Mr. Baker was retained by one of two parties who were working together, and they put him on the list. So unless we're going to have the completely hyper-technical basis for excluding Mr. Baker, that the words, I am an expert, were not an endorsement, when all of the material provided by him, which was used by the defense 8 months before they moved to preclude him in taking the depositions of our clients, then that cannot stand. That has to be an abuse of discretion. After all, the plaintiffs are entitled to have their day in court and to go off on, contrary to Trattler, to go off on that hyper-technical game of excluding for that reason just as inappropriate. The second issue has to do with the exclusion of Dr. Shoemaker. As I said before, the procedure that the court followed after they denied the motion for summary judgment based in part on what his opinions were, when the plaintiffs and their attorneys began to prepare in earnest for trial with all the expense that that entails, then to have that turned around at the last minute using another expert retained by the defense with no notice, we believe was also an abuse of discretion.
Counsel,
yes,
let's assume, and I'm not asking you to give up anything,
okay,
that we agree the trial court acted within its discretion in striking Dr. Shoemaker. That's just an assumption. Then do you agree that summary judgment was appropriate because you have no causation witness?
I have to answer that in two parts, or three parts. First of all, I would not give that up just as you suggested.
No,
I'm not. If it was not an abuse of discretion, that is the standard that applies clearly. But if he's out of the case, then I think what you're asking is, are we left with the situation where with Baker we have enough to get to the jury? And I think we do, but not nearly the strength of the case that we have with Dr. Shoemaker.
Well, Baker didn't offer an opinion on causation, did he?
He offered an opinion that the mold that was there was very dangerous to the health of these people. If you couple that simply with what the treating doctors found was wrong with these people, then I believe the argument is there anyway. But certainly, Your Honor, the argument could be made that we need both. And I would not want to go to trial without both of them, because I believe that's extremely important. Thank you, Your Honor. Well, with regard to Dr. Waxman, I will say to the court that even though the court said it was troubled by the lack of notice as to what he had to say, and that it didn't hope it didn't have to rely on what he said, but in fact ended up doing so, what the court did was not conduct the Schreck analysis. It compared opinions of Waxman with Shoemaker and decided, I don't find causation here. Those were her words in the record. She actually passed on the jury question of whether or not there was causation rather than exercising her gatekeeping function. Totally incorrect according to the law of the cases of Schreck and its progeny. So that's what she did. And it is important to understand the context in which she did that. She began, and this is from the supplemental record at page 184, where she said that the plaintiffs, quote, trying to show a connection from a totally different approach than linearly. And that approach has weaknesses from the court's point of view. But then at page 186, she said, I am not a scientist, and this is all new to me. The clincher was at page 195 when she said, I have convinced myself that he, Shoemaker, is onto something, but have not got to a point where he can say that WDB, water damaged buildings, always cause CIRS, chronic inflammatory response syndrome. Where did that come from? How can it be that you have to prove, not only in a Schreck hearing, but in a trial for purposes of proving causation, which we weren't to yet, that you have to prove that A always causes B before you can prove that because of what they got sick doing happened to them.
Mr. Freeman, is it your view that the trial court could not take into account or could take into account the fact that Dr. Shoemaker, had been excluded in other cases?
Well, that's one of the factors is whether or not he's qualified, and if he's excluded on occasion, that is something that the court consider.
Is that by itself enough?
No, I don't think so. He's been accepted 30-some times and was rejected just a few times, and the two cases she cited in her opinion, as we discussed in our brief, in our opinion, for the reasons we said in a brief, and I don't have time to repeat them here, but you've read those, make it clear that in one of the cases, there were other doctors saying this approach is reliable in the other case, and she cited that as the distinction from the present case. If anything, that supports our position. And in the other case, she said there was undue influence of the court on the peer-reviewed studies. I didn't understand that. But what we have here is, I think, not only a miscarriage of justice, but a clear abuse of discretion under the standards that this court and the Supreme Court have set forth in whether or not an expert passes the Schreck threshold. Just for example, one approach, and this is argued by the appellees and the court bought into it, the trial court did. The World Health Organization had found there was an association with water damaged buildings and CIRS. It was argued by the defense and underscored in its opinion by the court that that's the opposite of finding causation. But the cases we cited in our brief make clear that showing an association is an additional factor in determining whether there's causation. The difficulty we have here is that all of that, Your Honors, had to do with the proof of causation, not the Schreck gatekeeping approach. Here we have a doctor who had 5,500 patients with CIRS since 1998. In our case, he took a history, a physical, visual contrast sensitivity tests, compared with dozens of other cohorts with the same malady from the same source and with thousands of other patients, and compared that with controls, found that the situation that existed here, and he also took blood tests for 9 of the 12, found that the situation here comported with the cohorts and the other patients who were sick and were different from the controls. He has had hundreds of other doctors who have served as assistants in treating CIRS, 138 since 2008, and MDs from around the world have referred patients to him from 27 countries. Now, his approach was scientific, he's respected throughout the world, and he approached it by comparing thousands of people on one side and the other, and found that what he found in these patients comported with those who were sick and the other, and that was the basis for his opinion. To us, that seems like adequate, at least, to get to the jury.
Did he follow his own methodology with respect to these individuals?
I believe he did, with one exception. And that is, the court found that he did not rule out other confounding factors. But to the contrary, she required him to come forward and give affirmative proof that certain unnamed factors were not confounding. He said there are no confounding factors given the panoply of the symptoms that they have. And that was his conclusion. In any event, I have a minute and 15 seconds left. I think we have to, I'd like to save about a minute for rebuttal, but I think we have made our position clear with the owner's burden of having treating doctors prepare written reports, CVs, and fee schedules, which aren't required under the Colorado rule, and require us to do calculations for elements of damage in individual cases where those elements didn't exist. I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Christopher D. Bryan, on behalf of the defendants' appellees, and bar numbers number 35522. I'll take the last two issues that Mr. Freeman spoke about first, because I think we can dispense with those very quickly. The treating physicians are required to submit a written report or summary. If you read the rule of CRCP 26A2B2, it says that. To the extent that the plaintiffs want to rely on federal case law and want to make a distinction with the federal rule, former Chief Justice Malarkey made a very good footnote in the Gall case that said that there are a couple of differences in the federal rule and the state rule. The state rule does require a summary or written report. It doesn't require fee schedules or testimonial history or all the other things, but it does require a summary of what the opinion is, and most importantly for the trial court's purposes here, it does require a complete explanation of the opinions and bases therefore. Even the federal rule, which is different, also states that you have to at least provide a summary for non-specially retained experts, treating physicians in this case. That case, even if you disagree with that analysis, and the rule is very clear on that, it's still a harmless error, so I don't think that's going to affect your thinking very much here. As to the failure to disclose damages, that's something that's done at the beginning of a case, 30 days after at issue. That's CRCP 26A1C. They listed in their initial disclosures past medicals, future medicals, lost benefits, loss of capacity for income, lost benefits. All of those categories of damages are things that my clients planned to have to defend for, and so through written discovery, through depositions, throughout the course of the litigation, we asked for that information. It was never provided. Now, they have a duty to amend their initial disclosures under CRCP 26E. They failed to do that. Therefore, the court was appropriate in issuing Rule 37C sanctions for that failure. It did cause extreme prejudice, which is the term that the trial court used, because as little as 50 days before trial, we still weren't sure how much money the other side was seeking. Now I'll turn my attention to what I think are the two biggest issues here, which is the exclusion of Baker under CRCP 26A2. The difference here and all the case law that the plaintiffs cite is that CRCP 26A1 requires all parties to list all persons at the beginning of a case that might have relevant information. We don't know if that person is going to be instrumental to the trial or not, but we list them at the very beginning so that parties have full disclosure of that. That's very different than the requirements of CRCP 26A2, which requires, and it uses this term, in addition to the disclosures required by Part A1 of this rule. That means that it can't substitute for it. It means in addition to, the drafters of the rule chose to make that rule cumulative on top of the initial disclosure rule. All the cases that plaintiffs cite, which include Homeco from the Seventh Circuit, in which Judge Easterbrook said, well, if someone lists somebody on their witness list and you reserve their, you have a right to call anybody off their witness list, that's the functional equivalent of retyping it. And that makes sense. Here, Baker wasn't on our witness list. Baker wasn't disclosed by us as an expert. Nowhere did my clients list Baker except at the very beginning of a case because they did their due diligence and disclosed him as an initial disclosure individual, person likely to have relevant knowledge. So for the other side,
is your position that the reservation does not relate to the initial disclosures?
Their reservation should not be able to relate to our initial disclosures. The reservation of rights
in the cases they cite, was that the outcome, that the reservations did not relate to the initial disclosures?
None of the cases they cite are on all fours with this fact pattern. In Homeco, they cited that Seventh Circuit case that said that if you reserve the right to call someone off the other side's witness list from the trial management order 50 days before trial, that makes sense. We don't need you to retype everything. I reserve the right to call anybody that you put on your witness list. It also would make sense if we had endorsed Baker as our own expert, and they said, well, we reserve the right to cross-endorse or call anybody from your witness list. But that didn't happen here. We didn't think Baker was going to be called at all because they didn't list him 120 days before trial as required under CRCP 26A2B1, or B2 for that matter. So we didn't list him. We didn't think he was necessary. In fact, we think his report doesn't really help their case very much. The fact that that's the only person that they can find to attempt to explain that there might have been mold at this building might go to the weakness of their case, but that's beside the point right here. The point is that we should not have to surmise or guess that the other party is going to call someone from our initial disclosure list. If we didn't list them on the expert disclosures of our, we didn't list them on our trial witness list, and then they 4 days after discovery closes, get to endorse them. That's between disclosures and endorsements. And that's very important. That's why under the six-factor Todd test, the trial court here found that we were prejudiced. We did have to suffer not being able to take a deposition, not being able to line up and vet a refuting expert. We didn't get to subpoena his records. Now, opposing counsel cites Traveler. Traveler's different. The fact pattern in Traveler is the name of the expert was timely endorsed, but they did not give all the supporting materials, the fee schedule, the testimonial history, the publication schedule, the written report. But the other side at least knew that this individual was going to be called as an expert. That didn't happen here. That's the distinguishing characteristic there. As for the other cases they cite, brand name prescription drugs, that case actually cuts out away. It says that exclusion of an untimely endorsed expert was appropriate. In the Berry case, I think is important for this court to recognize because that is a Colorado case, unlike many of the other cases that they cite. There, the late disclosure of an expert witness, the Supreme Court found, was attributable to the natural progression of that plaintiff's medical care. And immediately after meeting with that doctor, she went out and amended her expert disclosures. That's the proper way to handle this. Here, they knew about Baker before they even filed suit. They didn't list him on their initial disclosures, notably. The only time he was ever listed was on our initial disclosures, and then 4 days after discovery closed, they decided to endorse him as an expert witness. The prejudice is palpable. The court did not abuse its discretion with respect to that. As to the Shoemaker or the Shrek exclusion, the trial court did a very thorough analysis here and did apply the criteria and prongs of Shrek in a very thoughtful way. First of all, it's important to remember that Dr. Shoemaker is not qualified. He's not a toxicologist. He's not an immunologist. He's not an allergist. He's not an epidemiologist. He's a family practice physician from Maryland who's not even licensed to practice medicine in the state of Colorado. Now, the crux of the trial court's decision, however, did not go to his qualifications, but rather to his unreliable methodology. And that's very important because even if you allow that he followed what he calls a five-step differential diagnosis, he didn't even abide by his own stated protocols. That means that what he did is not reliable. But let's look at what his differential diagnosis is. In medicine, a differential diagnosis is when you diagnose something by process of elimination. You exclude other possible concepts or explanations. This is the confounder terminology. Here, he didn't even ask about whether or not these people were habitual smokers, whether or not they were marijuana users, whether or not they had a history of asthma, a history of heart conditions, other pre-existing conditions. That's very important in any kind of medical diagnosis of whether someone is suffering from an illness that no other scientist recognizes, mold illness or CIRS, or as she's previously called it, CBAI. And the trial court noted that Dr. Shoemaker is the only person who calls this illness a disease. That's important for scientific community purposes. But even looking at his own differential diagnosis on his own terms, he didn't follow that. He didn't follow up with the patients. He met the patients in July 2006 for an afternoon and did a group diagnosis. He didn't even do an individual diagnosis. He said that all of them had the symptoms that would qualify for mold illness. That ignores the very essential fact that they had all left the premises at least 5 months before. They were no longer exposed to the allegedly toxic conditions or mold at my client's building for the follow-up that they met with Dr. Shoemaker. Yet they still exhibited these types of conditions. That indicates that there might have been other confounders that explained the other conditions that they were suffering from, or the 37 symptoms that they all allege they suffered from water damaged buildings.
Counsel, does taking a history by itself, though, provide some basis to rule out these other potential diagnoses?
If he did rule them out, it would have. But simply taking a history and asking a patient to subjectively check off certain conditions and then not considering that data after taking it, that's not scientific and that's not reasonably reliable for scientific methodology. Taking the information and then not consulting it and not using it and not relying on it, that's problematic.
Did he specifically ask the question or something like it to the effect of what's happened since you left the building, left employment in the building? has anything happened to you health-wise?
My understanding is that he asked what their symptoms were. In fact, if you look at the record, we do have a problem here because he didn't disclose all of the records that we needed for the strike hearing, and the court found that, but said that since she's going to exclude his testimony, further sanctions would be moot. So I don't know the full answer to that, not having all the information that he should have disclosed. But putting that to one side, my understanding is that he gave a checklist of symptoms and asked each patient to check off what they believe they had. So in many ways, he was submitting to them a closed universe of symptoms, asking them to self-identify which of those they might have suffered from.
Did he ever ask them, for example, do you smoke? Do you consume marijuana? Do you have allergies? Is there a history of asthma in your family? Does the record show he ever asked such questions?
The record does not show that.
Thank you.
And the record also shows that he should have asked that, and he did not, because if you look at some of the other publications that were submitted as part of his expert disclosure, that's something you're supposed to do. And that's what's very critical here, is he did not abide by the differential diagnosis that he himself said he would. This is the five-step methodology that the Young Court talks about when the federal district court in D.C. excluded his testimony.
Given the trial court's ruling on Baker, why shouldn't we be equally concerned about the trial court letting you call an expert at the Shrek hearing for which plaintiffs had less than a week's notice, if that?
Because we were not trying to call Dr. Lassman to testify at trial. And so the pre-trial disclosure rules of CRCP 26A2 apply to expert witnesses you're going to call at trial. We didn't know that the trial court was going to order a Shrek hearing. We filed a motion in limine in early December. They took the full amount of time to respond. I responded a day later, on Christmas Day, actually, and then the court shortly thereafter ruled on the motion in limine and said, I'm going to set this for a Shrek hearing. Immediately, we tried to line up an expert as quickly as we could, and we disclosed it shortly thereafter. So we had very little time preparing Dr. Raxton. It's not like we had him in our back pocket and we were planning to use him. We could have used him at trial. And to the extent that Dr. Raxton testified at the Shrek hearing, that does not mean that that testimony would have been admissible at trial. So there's no pretrial violation to the finder of fact. So I don't think there was any prejudice caused by that. Plus, Judge Nichols did not rely very much, if at all, on Dr. Raxton's testimony. Instead, she relied on what Dr. Shoemaker said. I realize that I have 2 minutes left, and so if I may very quickly, unless there are further questions about Dr. Shoemaker, and I'd like to sum up by saying that he didn't prove general causation, he didn't prove specific causation. Association is not causation, even under the materials that he himself submitted. And moreover, he didn't even identify the toxin that he says allegedly caused all these symptoms. That's important because we don't know the toxin, we don't know what the primary cause was, and we also don't know what specific concentration or threshold of that toxin is necessary to cause these symptoms. We were at a loss to prepare against this. The court realized that under the gatekeeper function, that would not be an appropriate witness. He did not satisfy Shrek, did not abuse its discretion. And speaking to an earlier point, Judge Webb, the motion for summary judgment to be overturned, that order, they would have to have you reverse the Baker exclusion and the Shoemaker exclusion. Without both, they can't satisfy the elements of their sole claim, and so summary judgment would still lie.
Why isn't Baker enough? If Baker opines that there are toxins present in the environment that are hazardous to human beings, and the human beings who were in that environment uniformly present, couldn't a reason?
No, for two reasons. One, Baker didn't say that. Baker said that in certain situations, some toxins generically may cause adverse health results. He didn't say that those particular toxins were at a sufficiently high concentration to cause that. The second reason is because you would need a scientist to say that I have examined these plaintiffs and that their symptoms were caused by this. He didn't treat the symptoms. He couldn't. He's not a doctor. All he did was do a report. I realize I have 30 seconds left. In the event that you do affirm the trial court's rulings, we do believe that we're entitled to costs under CRS section 1317-202. We did not make a non-monetary condition as part of that offer. All we did was make an offer to each of the individual plaintiffs. We said that we would offer them each $1,000 to dismiss the case with prejudice. We didn't know if all of them would accept, or none of them, or some of them. So we also included what was probably extraneous, but was essentially a CRE 408 statement that the offer or the acceptance would not be construed as a liability. Thank you.
Thank you.
For clarification, the toxins were identified by Mr. Baker. The specific toxin was identified in his reports as being at a very dangerous level to human health. So that is clear. With regard to Baker's striking of Baker, it wasn't just that Baker was endorsed in the initial disclosures as somebody who might have information that's important. The actual reports, his photographs, his lab studies, his sampling of the air and in the well were all disclosed, showing his opinions of how dangerous it was, showing the magnitude of the exposure that was there, 14 months before they moved to exclude him. And with regard to Dr. Shoemaker, if I can just finish this one sentence and I'm done, there is absolutely no doubt that he opined there were no confounding bases. Now, whether or not the specific non-confounding bases were listed, when the answer is in the negative, is trying to prove the negative. That was his opinion. That needs to go to the jury. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.